The theme for the evening talk is awakening and the heart. In the talk yesterday evening, I spoke to you about the final words of Bunjuji, bring the Buddha in, and I referred to potentially, possibly, three ways to understand that. One of them is to give some heartfelt reflection to the past, to the person of the Buddha, to invoke and awaken, in fact, those deep selfless qualities of Buddha's life, so that in some way they can genuinely manifest in our own life. And there is a strong tradition of that, and sometimes we do need the inspiration of persons in that way to nourish and cultivate heartfulness. I also referred to the importance to investigate and meditate into the divisions that we make with life, the fragmentations of views and perceptions, and one of the examples that I gave was how much the identification with I and my creates self and other. There is a gap between self and other, and all manner of views, prejudices, divisiveness, conflict and war in fact arises out of that. And in the dissolving of the ego, the blocks that go with it, there is the awakening and all the potential of what that is, and therefore in the language of yesterday evening, letting the Buddha in. And then thirdly, in the talk yesterday evening, third aspect of that, I also spoke about the place of teachings and knowing, the listening which takes place. And again, in that fullness and expansiveness of awareness, of clear and undivided presence and attention, then there can be again that awakening, and then that awakening, there's letting the Buddha in. What the Buddha means, awakened, the awakened one. And in all three features of that, there is certainly something of mystery and indescribability into the way these things happen and occur in the field of human existence. And certainly giving any one of those three, or preferably all three of those, some care and real interest in our life, truly furthers the great meaning when the Buddha himself said again and again that there are three jewels in existence, and the first one is the jewel of the Buddha. That means the jewel of full, clear awakening. The second one, the teachings, the Dharma, which point so immediately here and now, to it. And thirdly, the Sangha, where women and men meeting and coming together, truly dedicated and committed to the Dharma and to the Buddha, to awakening. And so sometimes in lending and attending to the teachings, with all the sometimes incomprehensibility and mystery which accompanies these things, we might ask, and we might ask quite appropriately, where is the heart in all of this? What is the significance, the place of the heart? For surely, if there is going to be some awakening in our life, and if there is going to be some shift, the most tangible and noticeable way for that to manifest, which making it, as it were, rather clear to ourselves and clear to others, is something happens to the heart. Something in the world of feelings and connection, presence in this world, shows, demonstrates itself in heartfulness, as well as in our views and understanding about the way of things. They're kind of outer demonstrations, they're indicators. We might even be so bold to say they're some proof of genuine realization, just as you and I, when we look on the ocean, and we just look at the waves, big or small as they are, the waves imply the ocean.
they tell us, oh, there is the ocean. And rather the same way, heartfulness and clear-mindedness, a warm heart and a clear mind, serve and contribute to the manifestation of what awakening is. So what of this? What of the heart? What of the manner and the place of the heart? And sometimes, whether of course in retreat or in other daily life circumstances that you and I participate in, it's all too terribly easy to be kind of moving along rather ordinarily in day-to-day life. And possibly and barely any real question arising from out of our being about matters of the heart. So that in other words, we can go from one day to the next. And in that, we just talk about what we talk about, we feel what we feel, we think what we think, we do what we do, and to some degree, our life will be shaped very much by the kind of movement and forces within ourselves. And if we are so lucky or so blessed to be reasonably well adjusted and reasonably well emotionally integrated, it will mean that our life will go along and we'll have some capacities in life to respond adequately to loss, adequately to change, adequately to friendship, to contact, to appreciation for the flowers and the trees, and our life will go along in that mode. No indicator of any awakening, of course, we're just rather blessed that our emotional life is reasonably well together. That's all. That's all it will indicate. Or we may not be in such a blessed and fortunate position where we can rely on our personal history, and that our personal history, in fact, is too troubled, it's too difficult, it's been too many disappointments, too many hurts, too much pain, too much regret, too much guilt, too much anguish in all the forms. And if so, and we're not attending to the difficult heart, the unhealthy heart, that difficult feeling life, then every time something happens to us, it's going to be one further proof of that we're a failure, one further proof that we can't handle change, one further proof that we're having difficulty in something continuing in the same old way and it's not changing and not going away. So the manner of the feeling life, the manner of heart life, is that some, and perhaps rather well and rather fortunate, can rely on their life, their inner life, to move along fairly well through life and cope and handle the difficulties of life that come inner and outer. Others know well enough, it doesn't take very much to start feeling afraid, it doesn't take very much to feel anxious or feel disappointed or get upset or get angry or become intolerable or whatever. It's all a matter of what's the condition of the inner life and especially what is the condition of one's heart, one's feeling life. Buddha himself said, all things come together in feelings. Mm-hmm. Think about anything in life, anything which really matters to you, it's really important to you, that counts for you. And you can't miss the feelings in it, whether they're pleasant or painful, one can't miss the feelings. So great attention is given in the tradition to feeling life. Perhaps no tradition on earth has ever attended so much to the heart as this tradition. And when I'm speaking of this tradition, a small aside here, especially in a place like Buddha Gaya and elsewhere, one will speak in the fragmentation of mind that there are many traditions, Buddhist traditions, and Advaita Vedanta traditions and other traditions, east, west, and north, and south. And it's a kind of conventionally agreed viewpoint. But I don't think you and I need to carry this. It tends to carry too quickly, too easy, divisiveness, sectarianism, which some of you expressed concern about during the retreat, and other factors. And I prefer, from the matter of heart and the matter of perception and the matter of view and the matter of relationship, to say and feel and think that there is one unnamed tradition. And wherever there is a pointing to awakening and to the awakening of the heart and the being, that is the tradition. And therefore the Buddha shares that tradition. Meister Eckhart shares that tradition. Ramana Maharshi shares that tradition. And many other saints and sages, east, west, north and south, share the one tradition that awakening is vital, it's an imperative, and it's available here and now. There's a single tradition of it. And you and I and others are participating in that unbroken single tradition right now. So in bringing a holistic and full perception to that, we then look to the heart. And one of you today in a one-to-one meeting brought up, and quite two people actually, one in a note and one in a one-to-one, brought up the relationship of the inner to the outer, called compassion. And what is the place of that? What is the relationship of awakening to compassion and its significance? In that, again, it's all contemplating heart. It's looking at heart here. And the first point, which I think is very important in here, one's got to be, if one wants to live with the truth, one's got to be honest. Truth and honesty go together like wood and trees. And in looking in that way, we speak of compassion as the action, not thought, not idea, action to end suffering. It is compassion. And awareness in life and heartfulness in life includes this manifestation. And it's an important factor, and it's so important factor that we say, prior to full awakening, the practice and the application and the consideration for compassion is a necessity. Part of one's practice includes awareness of others, the arising of suffering, and the practice to contribute to the end of suffering, as part of one's practice of humane and civilized and caring living, to look at the place of compassion in all of that. And as we know, in awakening, compassion comes out of it. It's prior, before, it's in realization, and in subsequent to it, it's still, heart is still of significance, of mattering. And countless gestures of retreatants to retreatants throughout this retreat have manifested and made clear, consciously or naturally or hardly noticed, multiple expressions of compassion. Sometimes one is sitting and one doesn't wish to move nor cough because one respects the meditations of the persons who are sitting near. That is compassion. Sometimes there has been little food left at the bowl at the end of the meal. One knows there might be other people nearby who are hungry around on the retreat, so one takes little or leaves it empty. One treads quite quietly in one's room. No wish to cause a fuss around, that one is engaged in being kind of transparent in this world, a non-entity, not drawing attention to oneself in any way whatsoever, and being in the silence and that beautiful transparency of things. It's compassion. Each time in the small groups, when on many occasions you've sat and you've listened and you've wanted to say something, and the thought has arisen, well, this person or that person seems to be saying a lot more, and one wonders whether one will get the chance to say something, and then the accompanying thought arises, well, this person obviously needs to talk, they're in more distress than I am, or more concerned to speak or whatever. If you could light the candle and move the candles away from the voice, please. And in that expression of just patience and waiting and allowing another human being to speak, and maybe taking more time than at the expense of oneself, all of that can be a demonstration of compassion. There can be compassion, obviously, and equally for oneself as well. Plenty of times during the days here, there's been various sicknesses that you've felt and some of the hardships that one can experience in this country as elsewhere. And though the mind and the heart may wish to do more for in terms of formal meditation practices in the sitting and the walking, one has looked at the condition of the body, one sees that the body needs rest. Rest is important for the healing process, and one has given and attended to that. It's an act of compassion for bodily life or organic life or oneself. So it's not as though compassion in that respect is kind of altruistic in just the do-good terms that some people misunderstand. It's an expression, in this case, of practice. It shows that others matter as much as oneself. Therefore, it shows an unfragmented perception. And in that unfragmented perception, the awareness is embracing beautifully and sweetly and all the deepness of human experience. We have the wonderful capacity to embrace each other, and surely no finer example and illustration of embrace is compassion. And in that respect, as the teachings have pointed out, in the act of the compassion, we may not realize how close we are to what a truly realized and liberated and free and joyful life really is. The very act itself and the very gesture of kindness towards others can obscure something deeper that's also taking place. Just a few months ago, where I was invited to Washington, D.C., and it was part of the campaign to end the production, the manufacture, and the use worldwide of anti-personnel mines, landmines. I remember when I was in southern Thailand in my days as a monk in the monastery, that in the surrounding villages in the province of Nakhon Sitamarat, about 15 hours south of Bangkok, there was a great deal of terrorism. And in the local hospital, quite regularly, people who had stood in anti-personnel mines were brought to the hospital. From time to time, Majen Damodaro would send me to the hospital. And with Dr. Suntong, who was my lay supporter in the monastery, and the doctor and surgeon at the hospital, and so go in to the casualty 10, 15, 20 minutes after somebody's foot was blown off by a landmine. Or going in there and seeing from terrorists or from the police or the soldiers the bullets in the backs of men, women and children, and you could see right through the back with huge holes, and watching the doctor in the theatre in the surgery with a saw cutting off half the leg. Why? Anti-personnel mines. It's a horrible and all war, of course, is vulgar to the nth degree, and to witness and see that. And so when I was in Washington, D.C., we were campaigning and working with the Venerable Maha Goshananda, fellow board member of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, nominated for the Nobel Prize 4 or 5 times. And we were sitting on the steps of Capitol Hill in a demonstration because the Clinton administration was refusing to sign the agreement to end the production of anti-personnel mines, along with, tragically, India, China, and Russia. And we stood there, and the media, the world's press were there, cameras and film crews and everything. And they came up to Venerable Maha Goshananda, who's the patriarch of Cambodia. He's 73 years of age. He's just sitting very quietly on the step in his robes, and just sitting very quietly. And they said, please, patriarch, please, venerable lady. I have no idea how to address these people. Please come and say something in the microphone. There's all these microphones there. And he walks up to the microphone very quietly, and he's a man of very, very few words. And he came up and he said very quietly into the microphone on the steps of Capitol Hill of the US Parliament. And he said, "The landmines which are in the ground the anti-personnel minds which are in the ground, started in our heart. And the anti-personnel minds are in our heart first. And they go from there to the ground. And therefore, we have to get rid of the anti-personnel minds in our own heart as much as we have to get rid of them in the ground. And then he said, Amen, and walked away. The world's press went... They just gasped. It was an extraordinary privilege to witness. And sometimes we forget. We forget in the blindness and the lack of awareness and the not seeing and of the place of what's inside comes outside and it goes there and it's in the ground. So when we're speaking of compassion, it's an act of compassion to get rid of the rage inside of ourselves, the violence inside of ourselves, the negativity inside of ourselves, the hostility, the righteousness, and all the fragmentation that comes with it. Because we say, oh God, there's anti-personnel minds in my own life. It's an act of compassion to work for that, because it's an act of compassion for others. Who on earth wants to be on the receiving end of violence and aggression and rage and hatred and intolerance? None of us. Therefore, we work on ourselves. Why? Because we're compassionate for others. In the attending to matters of the heart and the inner exploration of the heart, it means also with ourselves that any work on ourselves can become dry, can become habitual and mechanical. And if there's a feeling of that, as some of you experiences, or meditators, retreatants experience from time to time, and it's just in a kind of level continuum, just a kind of routine which is taking place there. And one just feels, as I say, the habitual mechanical process of just sitting and walking and these things that we have been speaking to you about. Then at times it's really worth stopping, and asking ourselves, where's the heart? It's quite possible, given the climate that we live in, the ideological climate I'm talking that we live in, that the heart, in human experience, in human beingness, in human nature, can actively begin to dry. That we can become so cerebral, so intellectual, so apathetic, so cynical, that we actually think we know, and the heart is drying up in all our cleverness. And as Ajahn Buddhadasa said to myself and others regularly in the last years of his life, he said, we won't destroy this world through ignorance in the conventional sense. We'll destroy it through being too clever. Too clever. And one feels concern about the degree of prejudice emphasis on the pursuit and the acquisition of knowledge, or the theory which runs and goes along with it. And that we can become so clever in business, so clever in making more money, so clever in getting what we want, so clever in being a so-called successful human being. And when that begins to happen in that way, the heart is getting neglected. And we had one woman, I remember some years ago on a retreat, and her husband was an executive for one of these oil companies. Huge salary, I think it was $750,000 a year or whatever it was. And his comment to his good wife was that he was a company man. That was the one-liner. I'm a company man. Always have been, always am, and always will be. And so she went along with that, as many others tend to, in a kind of dutiful way. And then one day she realized how utterly empty it all was. And she said to him, she was leaving the mansion, the cars, the lavish lifestyle, and all the perks of wealth and privilege. And she said to him, he told me, he can sit at the head of an empty table. His response to her was, you ungrateful bitch. Takes one exaggerated, one example to example, and many, many others which one hears over the years. And in the, there's something happens. So some neglect is going on, which we say of the heart. When we see some of you are parents and some of you will be parents. And when parents are constantly giving some expensive presents to their children, it's emotional blackmail. It's a way of not spending time with the children. So we give them something, keep them quiet. Why? People need the heart. The heart matters so much in life, and somehow or other, if we're going to go deep into life, we can't go deep into life, into the nature of it, nor into our experience, without drawing that out. Without seeing, this has a tremendous place in life. So therefore, we ask ourselves, what way has the heart expressed itself today? What has been a clear statement of it in my experience today? I'm asking them, and it's an important area. Hopefully, day in and day out, we look at and we reflect on. And it's not easy to do that, because when you and I turn our attention to the inner life and to the awakening and to heartfulness, sometimes it's a harsh waking up. And I've had plenty of people on retreats, plenty over the years, who said to me, at age in their life, 30 years of age, 40 years of age, 50 years of age, Christopher, I just realized I've wasted my existence. I blew it. I've wasted it. With tears and sorrow, I just didn't do anything with it. And I didn't do anything for anybody. I just thought, me, 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 I, the whole existence. Me and my family. Me and my job. Me and my country, or whatever the attachment and infatuation was all about. And I've wasted my life. And it's a horrible feeling when people feel they've blew it. The horrible feeling is they feel, well, you know, probably I just have one chance. I can't go on anything what others may say. It just feels like I've got one chance, and now, this latter period of my life, I've got to wake up. I don't want to go on living in this mechanical, habitual way, and all the tragedy of the self-delusion that goes with it. That's what we're speaking about when we're speaking of heart. Joy and compassion and love and deep feelings for existence. Sometimes when speaking of this, some people end up with, and very misunderstanding, it's a misclarity, it's a misseeing, a misrealization. And it can lead, in the awakening and the heart, to a danger, we've referred to this earlier in the retreat, of a kind of anti-intellectual view, an anti-mind view, and a kind of imbalance or an excess of heart as some kind of feeling exclusively. And this is where one has to attend, of course. And meaning in this particular case, I know people, and certainly in the Buddhist world, to take a very good example, that in the Buddhist tradition, and there is a tremendous interest in the teachings from many different standpoints. And one of them is that as much as possible, it endeavors to communicate in a thoughtful way. It allows, in the best sense of all of this, it allows not only freedom of speech and freedom of thought, but freedom of awareness to investigate. Very important feature. And in that, one can use one's discernment of mind to say, well, this is valid, and this is not so valid, this isn't valid, or whatever. And sometimes we have compassion in terms of models of people. Well, the Dalai Lama and other people that we love and respect greatly. But one forgets, and very easily forget, that there are people who we think of being rather thinking types, knowledgeable types, and who, as far as, say, Dharma goes, are actually doing just wonderful work. Wonderful work. Work in translation of ancient texts. Work in giving and organizing and arranging and campaigning. Work in writing brochures and leaflets and flyers. Work in giving good analysis to that, this, that, the other. Work in writing books, philosophical books and spiritual books and Buddhist books, etc. Mountains in multiple ways. And one may say of this particular person or persons, well, they don't seem to be heart very much in touch with their feelings. We say this, you know, a bit of the old therapy coming in. But they don't seem to be very much in touch with their feelings. And some, and having spoken to a number over the years, will say, you know, Christopher, I'm very well aware of the feedback that comes to me regularly. And one's partner says it, or one's teacher says it, or the Sangha says it, or it comes in on the email. Or and people say, I'm very much aware that people say I'm not in touch with my feelings. But when one knows a number of these people and has contact with them, what they are doing with their mind is wonderful. Wonderful in getting the in various ways, the teachings established, using their mind well. And they may seem, oh, not so much the feeling type, but it would be a tragedy and an aberration of awareness if we were suddenly to start elevating emotions and feelings as being what matters most, and not realizing that quiet inner life, quiet feelings, doesn't mean to say absence of feeling. Just the feeling life of some is very, very quiet. Very quiet feeling life, very, very quiet emotional life, and so she or he may not be especially verbally expressive. He or she may not feel great emotional waves and great urges of compassion and love bursting out of them all over the place and etc. Thank goodness, and yet they have a deep feeling for others, a deep feeling for doing their best for others, using their respective skills, intellectual or whatever they might be, deep feeling for teachings or whatever. And they will, as I said, they would say, Christopher, I've done therapy, and in the old days I beat the pillow. It's gone out of fashion these days, I see. And I've done the screaming and the yelling or whatever it might be, etc. But I'm still just feeling life is quiet. Don't have a lot of waves going on inside of me. And yet, ask that person to do something. See what that person is doing. Feeling is there. Love of Dharma, love of teachings, love of service for others, using their practical skills, intellectual skills, etc. So it's vital in understanding about awakening that we don't create an artificial and unfair wedge between those who are more mentally orientated, we might say, those who are more feelingly orientated, might say, those who are more analytical, those who are more intuitive. These are all artificial webs, but they have the danger of becoming forms of spiritual discrimination, as ugly and as unacceptable as any other kind of discrimination that you and I protest about. Therefore we say, hey, let's acknowledge let's attend to, let's appreciate the whole being. Let's see if the whole being can awaken. And in that awakening of the whole being, let's see how it manifests. Let's see what flows out of it. And some may say, oh, this person appears and seems very compassionate, because we look and we see what he or she or they are doing through their action for others or for animals or the environment or whatever. And some of our brothers and sisters in this world, both in this area as well as further afield, take risks with their lives because they value others as much as themselves. And then there are others who are much more meditative and contemplative by their being. Doesn't mean to say that they're devoid of compassion. Sometimes their silence and their stillness, and their sustained silence and stillness, is such that it inspires. They generate a vibration. They generate an atmosphere. And as a number of you know in this retreat, as I've seen for myself, and I've mentioned it to a few of you here, that we see some of the people on the retreat and they're extremely still in the sitting, and every time they go to the walking place, it's more or less the same place, and very meditative and caring walking. Then we see, gosh, the quality of presence and the beauty of the person and the care and the sensitivity and the respect for themselves and for each step. We say, whew, it's wonderful to see. And that person won't think of it in terms of being compassionate for others, but it touches us, it inspires us. And we say, gosh, there's such a dignity in the presence of such a human being who just sits respectfully, who walks respectfully, who's very moderate in all the things that they do through the day. And it touches something deep and appreciative and a gratitude, I'm sure, from many of us. And say, maybe I can just be inspired by that example. Maybe I can just sit a little while longer and walk a little while longer and just get a sense of what that might mean. And so all of that is heartfulness and receptivity and being centered. And as I say, the vibration of it, to use the word, the vibration of it, the outcome of it, it touches other people. And sometimes we can't see, finally, we can't know. The Venerable Mahagoshananda that I referred to with regard to the anti-personnel mind. He and I were in the same monastery together. We were together 3 or 4 years. He came a little while after myself. We never saw him. He was always in the hut. We didn't know if he was sleeping all day or what he was doing, but he was always in the hut. He was the only person in the monastery who was allowed to stay in the hut all day, because the Ajahn didn't trust the rest of us. And sometimes, time to time, I would go to his hut of Mahagoshananda. He'd invite me in for some tea, for some chai. And he had all sorts of notes stuck up on the board, on the wall in his little room, a couple of meters by 2.5 meters, or whatever. And one just thought of him as a contemplative. But he's just a contemplative, and he just contemplates and meditates and lives with simplicity and utterly undemanding on anyone and on life itself. Now, in April or May, he makes walks in Cambodia. And in these walks in Cambodia, there's risk, Khmer Rouge, risk of reaction. He tells the parents, tell your sons to put down their rifles and kill the hate inside of themselves. He tells the children, tell your fathers to put down their rifles and kill the hate inside of themselves. And he walks. And pilgrims and more walk with him year by year. And he said, I said to him years ago, I said, Thanh Maha, they're going to nominate you for the Nobel Prize if you continue like this. I know, Christopher, he said, it makes me laugh, because if they do, they'll only be nominating me for the Nobel Prize for doing walking meditation. awakening of the heart. Let us have 2 silent minutes together, please.